Yeah, you've never actually occupied any moment, let alone the present moment. Only the myth of mind suggests that's the case. Through what we refer to as memory, we're too busy remembering the myth of ourselves than actually being present. So we blot out the illumination of the present by remembering ourselves, which is replaying something, anything we think happened, which includes what we think is happening now. It's easy to recall what happened 5 minutes ago or 10 minutes ago, a day ago, or perhaps 10 years ago. It's trickier to see that you're actually remembering yourself now. Sensation that you have, that or thought or whatever that you assign some kind of characterization to, you're remembering yourself. So memory is not necessarily of the past, its memory is really of the present.
It's just preoccupied with itself, I guess.
Yes, that's right. See, the movement of metaphor and association and assignment is memory, and it's memory of what we think the present is. But if you really give, let's say, your attention to what might be referred to as the present or presence, you can't say anything about it. It's absolutely beautifully, nourishingly empty. What you comment upon is an idea. You can't actually comment upon what's actual. You can comment upon ideas. Ideas, comment upon ideas, comment upon ideas. So the creation of the past occurs right now, not prior to now, which is interesting. The present is turns out to be the past. Like when does the past stop being the past, and when does it catch up with the present?
When it's passed out.
It's always the past. It's always the so-called present. When does the present become the future? Always. You can't actually find a boundary field between what you call the past, what you might refer to as the present, and what you could be anticipating or not and refer to as the future. Where's the gate? Do you remember passing through the gate from the past to so that you could get to the present, and then passing from the present into the future, which becomes the new so-called present, instantaneously also becoming the past? You can't find any boundary between the three.
Time tunnel.
Yeah?
Perfect sense. It's just makes me laugh.
It would.
It does.
If you have any fucking sense, it would make you laugh.
It does.
Yeah.
I just think that's it's so common sense, but it's so wild.
When does your recollection of the past stop being your recollection of the past? Even what you are presuming is occurring now is a recollection of the past. Because you can't say what's happening now. And any metaphor that arises, any assignment or accusation that occurs, it's already too late. Continuum of past, present, future doesn't quit. And yet we are capable through dubious means of constructing what we think is a clear delineation between what happened a moment ago, what's happening now, which is always a moment ago, And then what's happening next, which is happening now, which is a moment ago. It's absolute twilight zone.
So anything captured is there's a delay, and it's always about the past, even if it's the future, the thought about the future.
Well, it's very hard to say when it occurs. Mm-hmm. Is there a delay? No, of course there is. I can't. Yes, of course. No, there can't be. But wait.
Well, something tickled an event, and the event popped out. It emerged. Thought, you know, a notion.
But that's happening now.
Being enamored by the immediacy of.
Yes.
Even being out of your mind.
Okay. Are you recalling things that happened prior to now?
I'm doing the same thing. I'm reflecting on
states. Yeah, but you can't be, really. You can only be expressing what appears to be memory of something prior, presently. Nothing actually happened before now. You can't find it. Even if you take out old photographs.
Like Ryan says, what, tell your story. And I'm thinking, my story is right now. So my story is, there it goes. Oh, my story is, there, it's gone. There's my story. Oh, it's gone.
That's right.
It's constantly, it's like,
the only way to have a so-called story.
And before you even can get the words out, it's a new story.
It's that quick. Might be faster than that.
Right.
So what you can then begin to discern is that, this is really just a streaming forth of association.
When do kids, it's almost like it's innate, like you should know this, right? So when do kids lose this? Or when could you?
You can find varying opinions on, so-called human development. They're not true, but you can find them.
But even the assertion of true and not true is kind of like presumptuous in a way. Right?
Yes, it has to be. Mm-hmm. Yeah. If you lean too heavy on not true, or if you lean too heavy on true,
I guess you're better off declaring something not true than something true.
Yeah. Up to a point, negation has a certain advantage.
Quite a minute.
And yet the, whatever present, whatever can be found, discovered, or felt has a positive nature. It's joyously luminous. So you can go neti-neti to the extent that serves you, or you can, enjoy the throbbing nature of radiant presence for as long as that serves you. One's not necessarily better than the other.
I guess if you hang too long in any one place.
Well, you can't, actually, but you can fool yourself, or consciousness can fool itself into imagining that it's overstayed its welcome.
Thinking of Forrest Gump, tired of running,
mm-hmm.
Everybody following him, because there's this phenomenon. They're looking for deep meaning. He's going, why are you stuck? I'm tired. I want to come home. Why are you running? I don't know. I feel like running. brings a smile to that part of my mind that is always looking for something, you know?
Yes. That's right. See, necessity and self are the same.
Yeah, I'm thinking of the bare necessities and the bears dancing around.
Dancing bears on the blotter.
That's what's interesting sometimes is reassociating. It's like you're not going anywhere and you're not looking to go anywhere, but then one synaptic experience leads to the next and to the next and the next.
Yeah, that's right. Synaptic leapfrog. Mm-hmm. You know, the culture at large doesn't do that great a job of emphasizing presence, sans conceiving. You could say it does the opposite of that. It encourages constant distraction and constant entertainment and the pressure of becoming. The civilization is marked and perhaps marred by the myth of more, the myth of becoming, the angst of misunderstanding. So then deceit and exploitation, you know, becomes the way to get ahead. It's only extreme pathological insecurity that pursues control.
Where do you think that impulse comes from at the beginning? When that grabs something and manipulate it, control it, or be in charge of it.
Well,
master it.
Yeah,
overcome it,
hard to say where anything comes from. It would suggest that, you know, we things, the civilization, might be better off in some other condition. And of course, you know, you can become a progressive activist in so many regards these days. Or, if ever, always. Where does anything come from? This appears spontaneously in whatever level of complexity it appears as. The pursuit of a history or a cosmology or a genesis of creation is just part of the, you know, the ruse of deception. As if you were here before now. Or as if the earth were here before you were born. Or the the inflation began 14 billion years ago. None of these are true. In everything we've been told by scientists, politicians, priests, gurus, educators, bobbleheads on TV, are all lies. Including the physicists. And for sure, the CDC. If you were asked to pause for the cuckoo, the mindfulness cuckoo.
Yeah, they're tweeting
me. What cosmology would you cobble together from the resources at your disposal if you hadn't already been duped into believing everything that everyone told you? What would you say about the presence of experience? Without placing it in a second-hand context.
If I'm counting on the senses, it would have a sensory nature to it.
Yeah, most would agree with that.
I like looking at how life starts tiny, grows, matures, it gets old, and then it dies. If it's a bug.
That was quick.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, bugs are quick.
Yeah.
Like your kids looking at bugs and then looking at life and going, oh, yeah, I guess I'm part of that.
Well, it's...
That's depending on the five senses.
Yeah.
To make reality.
Yeah.
I think the question is bigger than the five senses. Pretty sure.
It might be more inclusive than what we refer to as the artifacts appearing to the five senses.
Yeah, so it's a space where none of it matters at all. And another space where it desperately matters.
Tends to fluctuate.
Clearing with someone, like everything was fine.
Yeah.
And then it crashed.
Oh.
Two other people got involved, poisoning the well.
Hmm.
But then again, there's the story that just emerges from it.
Yes.
And I play it back, and then it repeatedly upsets me.
Sure.
So why would I keep playing back stuff that upsets me?
Yeah. Nobody asked you.
Yeah, I'm taking this self a little too seriously.
That's what it's meant to do.
Take itself seriously.
What else would it be without it?
And then discover that it doesn't need to be that serious. I really have myself fooled for a number of years.
Good for you. Well done.
Thought I was the laid back one.
All right. Well, it's good to have an identity, even if it's a fallacious one.
Oh, it's constantly fallacious one. Mm-hmm. soon as you land, it's formation.
All that can be found is deceit. There's no pristine, sacred reality on the other side of the curtain of deceit. There's just deceit, top to bottom. There's just deception, top to bottom. The seeing of it, the acquiescence. Might open a portal to something or some nothing that perhaps might be sensed. But if we're worshiping heroes and mutants, then we're always under the influence of becoming. We're always secondhand. If I'm worshiping heroes and mutants, I'm always secondhand. The Buddha knew better. He had a better experience than this one. Yeah, no, he didn't. Just didn't. Neither Christ, nor Muhammad, nor Allah, nor Abraham, nor Nirsagadatta, or Larry Hall, for instance. But you see, the civilization is built on the mythic worship of heroes and mutants.
So they spun a better story.
It appears so. And so we remain secondhand. We remain as beggars to the story that we've spun.
If you think if you didn't have all the negative, you know, all the stuff that you said, it might not be deceit. It could be something pure.
Well,
if you didn't have,
go in, you'll see.
That.
You'll see that even pure is just another whisper of deceit.
I never
yeah, you see, it's the anticipation that there could be something untarnished, untainted, wholly pure, ascended, which is the worship of heroes and mutants that keeps you in the game.
I think it's the nothing. It's just the nothing that's the pure. Because there is nothing.
Well,
how can nothing be a deceit? It can't be deceit because then it's not nothing.
Well, yes. Of course, once it's converted into poetry, then it can't help but becoming another element of deceit.
And then it's contaminated.
Yeah. Yes. Right. But that's how the worship of heroes and mutants gets going. We objectify heroes and mutants as being sacred and holy and other and untainted. And then we do the crusades. See? So all that can actually be found is deception. It can be very rarefied deception. It can be inspiring deception. It can be worthy of worship deception. But once you place some kind of notion on an idealized person and an idealized condition, an idealized reality, then you're a beggar. Then you're secondhand. because that means it's other than you. Not the case. It's not the case. It's just not the case that Buddha or Jesus or anyone had a leg up on this, accomplished something greater than you. It's not possible. Maybe more rarefied. Maybe, you know, had kind of a mutant gene. Maybe it was looked like some kind of, you know, religious or spiritual heroism by virtue of, you know, suffering or scaling the castle, the palace wall, or whatever the story is, right? Makes it look like they were special, unique, destined for greater things than you or I could even dare hope to taste or accomplish. Yeah. And if not the persona, then, you know, Brahman, you know, the Tathagata.
It just occurred to me that it's sort of a behavioral conditioning in a way.
Absolutely.
If you conform, you just might get close to, you might reach that. I always like the contradictions that says, you know, you're going to listen to Jesus. If he says, you can do it in greater, I can hear that. Because then it takes the seat that's unreachable to the floor or accessible.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, what are we relying on as the evidence for, you know, spiritual, religious, or whatever accomplishment? What are we relying on? This big ball of deception is the measure.
You better not measure it then.
Well, measure is deception. Measure is deception. Measure is self. Measure is time. Measure is contrast and comparison. Measure is conceiving. Measure is being without. Measure is the acute insecurity that turns someone into a malevolent leader, like the present political administration of the United States. It's malevolence all around. But that same malevolence happens in a tiny little, you know, whatever this is called, interfaith institution.
You could say malevolence without a charge to it is a catalyst.
If you imagine something has occurred and something else is likely to occur, then you instantly have anything could be held as a catalyst. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, but usually something where people react to or feel strongly about.
Well, yeah, I mean, we have all of human history to look to for the undulation of righteousness and the failure of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we have less couch potatoes now. More people, at least with higher blood pressure.
Yep.
Or depending on what side you're on, they might be selling more beer too.
Yeah.
It is interesting that in the mind, as it pursues something and it's getting closer, it feels like it's going to miss something. The person that's minding their own business, doing nothing special, the event emerges out of a mundane space and time. I know that's really thick. I keep conjuring all over the place. It's like mushrooms
uh-huh.
after a rain.
Yeah. It's like the molasses tank broke and we're all going down.
Yeah, I got a lot of stuff in my belly. No, I'm not talking about food.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so to simplify things, not that that's necessarily advantageous. It might be worthwhile to discover what the cessation of necessity feels like, what the cessation of conceiving feels like. What it feels like not to be pushed around by the imagination of your own future, or pushed around by the imagination of your so-called past. To be released from existential restlessness. That kind of nourishment goes deep.
It's like a good night's sleep where you slept straight through however many hours, six, whatever. You don't get with once. Your mind's not churning, and it's so peaceful.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can't even describe it.
No.
You can do that during the day when you're awake, too.
Yes. Liberation is innate. It's not acquired. Free from making any claim. One doesn't insist on the habit of self-assessment or self-accusation, relying on imaginary artifacts. You're not in a condition.
Question that comes up, and who am I?
It needn't. The who is another form of claiming, right?
Yeah. And who's asking, right?
Sure.
What's asking?
Yeah, those kinds of questions, you know, may have been somewhat insistent in your so-called past, but through association with cessation, they're not so pressing. This is autonomous. Therefore, so-called you are autonomous. You don't have to pass through purification or explanation or teaching or hierarchy or authority to be what this already is. It's innate. Now, of course, in the course of one's life, there are karmic agendas, hormonal agendas. The future is calling. You're going to discover how it will be fulfilled in you through your education, through your family, through events and circumstances, who you fall in love with, who you have a family with. Whether you live long enough for those things to occur or be satisfied. You could say at some point in the imagination of your life, you don't have as much of a future as you thought you once had. You've arrived. Your future becomes your present. And so there's not a ton of, let's say, uncertainty or anticipation or hunger or thirst for more or better or different relationships or exotic places or more drugs to take or more books to read or more movies to see or more credentials to acquire. At some point, your future arrives. Maybe that's disappointing because, yikes, you might be getting older. Or it might be quite pleasing because it's like, oh, good. I don't have to concern myself with all of the uncertainties of the imagination of my future. I can just rest in inconceivability. In a sense, you have to, or tongue-in-cheek, you have to grant yourself permission to rest in inconceivability. Otherwise, the restless imagination of your as-yet unfulfilled future will distract you. It wasn't possible to rest in inconceivability when you had plenty of future left to live. Because it would feel like you were kind of cutting yourself off or selling yourself short somehow. But now, whenever that now arrives, oh, well, fuck my future. I can rest in inconceivability. And you do so, you could say, concomitantly with the withdrawal of placing more and more loyalty in heroes and mutants. You're right, you have to kind of constructively withdraw from the myth of the civilization so that you can rest in your own autonomy. You're always wondering if someone's having more fun than you. And you're going to go find them. You're going to go get that fun. No one should be having more fun than me. Quiet down.
That'll take about 3 minutes.
With the pursuit of fulfillment, one guarantees to more or less remain unfulfilled. Because then fulfillment is a codependent, dysfunctional relationship with more, other, better. So then one's autonomy now has become dependent on circumstances and events, on some kind of joy or accoutrement to be found in someone's future. So that is how one persists in being undernourished, malnourished.
That wouldn't be autonomous anymore.
And it's no longer autonomous. That's right. Now you are dependent. Yeah, you're dependent on, let's say, the good graces of God, or luck, or faith, or hard work, or elbow grease, or deceit and manipulation to get what it is you think you deserve, or want, or need. So you remain in a codependent relationship with circumstances and events. And that's not going to bring you anything. Even if you were to succeed at all of the distractions and entitlements that you covered yourself with, even if you were to succeed at all of those, you'd have nothing to show.
In the mind, you'd think of more things.
It would. It always does. The sense of creaturehood, identification, time, responsibility, accountability. Those are all the it's all the outgassing of conceiving.
It's the what?
The outgassing of conceiving. Symptoms of conceiving. We wonder, why can't I be happy? Why can't I be loving? Why can't I be loved? Why can't I? Why can't I? Why can't I? Well, because you're a buffoon. you're a mythic extrapolation of the myth of conceiving as self. So your closest compassion or companion or both will be undernourished.
Your closest companion is your misery.
It is. Yep.
It loves company.
It does. That's why all the Aborigines gather around the fire at night.
I like that guy from a technology guy. He actually is using some Aborigine artifacts. His YouTube channel, he goes out and just with nothing, makes stone axes and builds a hut, and he's making clay pots and doing all this primitive technology stuff.
Nice.
But then he actually has he finds literal Aborigine artifacts, and he's using them to crush nuts and make whatever bread, and he's baking wild almond bread or whatever.
I
like that too.
That's far out. Yeah.
I wonder, while he's doing that, if his mind is thinking, oh, I can't wait to get home and get a hot shower. Oh, how much he spent. Is his, what I'm saying, is his brain operating like a human being brain, or is he so intent on what he's doing that he's almost in a state of
Aboriginal bliss.
He's probably been on it, I would imagine. He's been doing it for 5 years. Insane. He's made five houses. He's made all these tiles. He's made he made a forge. He was smelting iron that he dredged out of the stream. He spent so much time out there. He's not doing what he's loved. And he loves. I have no idea why he's out there.
And industrious.
Well, I'm just thinking because he's not surrounded by all this, I don't know, for lack of a better word. Technology,
yeah,
TV, radio.
When
you pump gas in, there's music
playing.
Like,
I feel like getting out the duct tape.
Constantly. Because he's out in nature, his brain.
I bet.
I don't know if we're just
sitting in the jungle for a while. You calm down.
Yeah.
Probably much of the appeal. It's like in that TV show Lost, he's there with the loom weaving that I don't know what you would call it, and the one dude's like, oh, looks like it's taken a long time. He's like, that's the point.
Yeah, so they're trying to reach some sort of a production quota. Yeah, in a smaller way, the rhythm I had at the cottage, gathering wood before the winter. And burning it, and it felt like being warm. Or not burning it, and feeling, enjoying the adaptation to the cold. There wasn't a whole lot of future past stuff going on. It was, there was an immediacy to it. Kind of reflected and said, there's too many folks that could relate to this. No chains in this world. What? 17 degrees inside? It was one time. Yeah. Didn't feel like making it.
It seems like there's some more manual stops and brake pedals too, maybe.
It's like the Samoyeds. They go a little nutsy. They don't get enough exercise. But if you work on them, have them pull sleds and do stuff, they're as happy as anything. There's a certain sedentary element that works against us. You don't necessarily mean sedentary in a meditative way. Well, then maybe some could see that as second. Can't meditate all day, can you?
Try stopping.
Yeah, I was thinking about maybe doing a week-long solid retreat as a vacation. Yeah. A couple weeks of vacation to use to see it.
Good idea.
That might be a nice, relaxing way to spend the week. Maybe it'll make me go crazy, even who knows.
It's very nice. Sustained sitting and walking practice. Very nice.
And then go to the class and off from there.
Get you down back up. Let's say we go to a music hall and we're looking forward to certain classical pieces being performed by gifted musicians. So our attention and our anticipation is honed to receive the intricacy, the dynamism, the nuance, and the timing of the performance. Do we give that same quality of attention to what's present? We don't see what's present as being of the same or perhaps different quality of performance, where whatever is appearing as thought or sensation or sound is symphonic. We don't derive the same pleasure or nourishment from the symphony of present experience. It's good to be able to do it once in a while. You must have season's tickets. But that's part of the dance, right? I'll go put on my nice clothes, make sure I have my tickets, maybe go out to dinner, then go to the theater to, right, enjoy the event. But same kind of
availability to so-called ordinary experience is impossible to find. Because then I live with restlessness and becoming and stories and mental distractibility. I'm not kind of sitting in my theater seat, just enjoying whatever silence or gesture or tonality that nature or reality has to share with me. I'm consumed with the imagination of myself. And I live in an ocean of distraction and irritability, psychological time, becoming. These kinds of conversations or yoga inquiry, call it what you will. This is, you know, it's about listening to and enjoying the symphony of your self. The symphony of what's present, having enough patience and maturity to rest in the spaciousness of it. In the pause. And there's a lot to be found in the pause. In the spaciousness of one's own quiescent availability. It's like cue the breeze, cue the door. Whatever is arising, whatever can be felt or discerned is right on time. So we become released from the habit of becoming and the quarrel that we have with it. We become released from contrivance. in the midst of the, you know, ongoing display, symphony of consciousness, there is cessation. Neither is absolute to the dismay of the other. Softening of self-identity. There's not much sense in pining for an enlightenment event. This is the enlightenment event. This is liberation. It always has been. You can see for yourself the wonder of the cessation of necessity, the cessation of becoming. You see it for yourself. What would be the point of saying you can't use the Buddha to find the Buddha? What?
Yeah, it seems pretty crazy. It's like, yeah, there's the Buddha.
We found it. It worked. Contrary to your advice, it worked.
How long can it stay in a container? Not very long.
Thank you. talking with a friend from California this morning, and he's been an ardent and well-schooled student of Buddhism in its many forms, and enjoyed the company of all kinds of teachers of varying degrees of skill. Feeling that despondency that you can feel when you realize you can't accomplish this, when you don't have the verve and the constitution to pass through the fire of the fire and the ardency of, you know, deep Buddhist practices. But still you imagine that is the proper path for your fruition. Yeah. So we spent quite some time on the phone looking at the, you know, the great karmic wonder that's been his miserable life. And we can all say that. And the delight of being released from the lock and key that one's own mind holds one under. And penetrate the myth of heroes and mutants.
Did he get it?
He did. Yes.
It's a money maker. I bet you spent a lot of money.
Yeah, you know, his fair share. Kind of a disability guy. So he hasn't blown a ton of dough on all this stuff, but more so than money, a lot of, you know, years, right? And, you know, a lot of years of affliction and doubt and aspiration and practice and failure and, you know, suffering 101.
Is he listening?
I doubt it, no. Yeah, so we, you know, stirred the pot and threw a little sprig of whatever in there from time to time, and he was able to relax from that kind of intensive urgency that he is capable of having, you know, for despondency. But that's a good sign. I mean, the measure of your despondency is also a measure of just how sincere and motivated you are, right? That this misery comes to some fruition. Otherwise, you wouldn't be so despondent.
So misery is a catalyst in a sense.
Yes, absolutely. The despondency and the energy of the despondency was a catalyst that we were both fortunate to rewire into autonomy. Freedom from heroes and mutants. Yeah, so it was, you know, quite lovely. It's nice. That kind of, you know, deliverance and release from the myth of one's own mind is, you know, cherished. He's not a seeker anymore. He understands that the accoutrements of seeking are for, you know, younger, more restless, perhaps miserable persons than himself. Now he understands, he's capable of discerning what the cessation of necessity feels like, what the cessation of conceiving feels like. Rest there, right? he's gotten to his future. He's arrived at his future. And so now what's left? More seeking, more drama fields, more pursuit of, you know, retreats and fanciful ideas? No. Simple. Rest in the absence of conceiving.
The sound in the workshop grows more distant.
Yeah. Consciousness moves from wanting to generosity. And as it fulfills itself, moves from the victimization of wanting to the, let's say, embodiment of generosity, well, it just shares by its nature. We don't make any claim for ourselves because there's none to be made. Presence is autonomous. It's generous. It's not withholding. Yeah. Kick this around.
Good stuff.
Long enough.
Very nice. We could not possibly meditate it tonight. Sometimes the mind needs something.
Yeah, it wasn't a good night for meditation then.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for joining us, folks. See you at the next roundup.